Hello, fellow Earth folks. I'm Annie Gigg, GYG, here on CFRU 93.3 FM and CFRU.ca, available wherever you are in the world. Warm welcome to Better Me, Better World, the show for growth-minded changemakers, difference makers, and happiness makers. In the prior few episodes, I've been telling bits of my personal story in hope of inspiring you to share your story. Why? Well, it can be therapeutic. Help you work through blockages or areas of discomfort. It can help you move past debilitating blame and shame. It can be empowering by virtue of enhancing your self-awareness and self-understanding that enables you to be the change maker, difference maker, and happiness maker you want to be. And of no lesser importance, it can be the story that a listener really needs to hear. It can provide content for their survival guide. As I mentioned last week, in this episode, I'm sharing about a couple of particularly memorable occasions in the past few years when I've intensely felt one with all. One with all being the topic of the previous chapter in my story. This sensation of being one with all is, to my mind, what life is most worth living for. It has given me a sense of belonging to the whole, of being whole, fully alive. It has enabled me to understand that separation and otherness are nothing more than illusions of the mind, that it's impossible to be separate. Another way to think of one with all is in flow. And chapter 7 of my story, which I'll get into shortly, I'm calling In Flow. But before starting into the new chapter, let's consider for a bit what it means to be in flow. In that state where you want to spend as much of your life as possible. Let's begin with the Wikipedia description of the term. I quote, "Flow in positive psychology, also known colloquially as being in the zone or locked in, is the mental state in which a person performing some activity is fully immersed in a feeling of energized focus, full involvement, and enjoyment in the process of the activity. In essence, flow is characterized by the complete absorption in what one does and a resulting transformation in one's sense of time. Flow is the melting together of action and consciousness." End of quote. Wikipedia continues in its description of flow saying, and I paraphrase, that it's the enjoyable, calming, stress and anxiety reducing state of concentration that happens when there is a balance between your skills and the challenges of the task at hand. And with this, I agree. However, I feel this implication of flow happens only when a person is engaged in a Goldilocks challenge or activity is too limiting. I believe the sensation of being in flow can happen in any situation in which you merge with everything, when essentially you lose sense of time and space because, well, you've become one and the same with them. Some users of LSD say one of the most profound parts of the experience is a deep oneness with the universe. I think being in flow is that same hallucinogenic-like experience without need of a chemical substance, although I'm not speaking from first-hand experience as an LSD user. The first time I heard the term in flow was back in the 1990s, during a particularly challenging period of my life when my psychologist used it to explain an experience I'd described to him. This is what I'd told him. It was a warm summer night. I was mentally, emotionally, and spiritually exhausted after a day of working in the office, mothering four young kids before and after work, and interacting with my husband within our unhappy, dysfunctional relationship. I went out into the dark and sat down on the cool patio flagstone step facing the forest, above which a full moon was rising. As I was staring at the moon, everything melted away. My exhaustion, my financial and relationship worries, my must-dos, the overwhelm, the house behind my back, the coolness of the flagstone, the grass and trees beyond the patio, the crickets, the night. I recall the feeling being as if the moon was assuming me, taking me in, drawing me up, just me, without any of my thoughts attached. I'm not sure how long that experience lasted time-wise, but it was long enough for me to feel washed in peace. I was in flow, my psychologist said. I suspect, but again cannot say from personal experience, that people who practice meditation aim to achieve that state. Before relating the two main stories I want to tell today, there's one other occasion I clearly recall of getting into flow around the same time period while I was still living in the same house. It was winter this time, deep freeze winter, with plenty of snow on the ground. Again, it was nighttime with a bright moon, and again, I had to flee the house or risk exploding or crumbling or turning into mush or whatever may have happened due to life stressors being too much in that moment. I was in my bathrobe and slippers, and although it was well below 0 Celsius outdoors, I didn't take the extra couple of minutes to put on a coat and boots. I struck out across the snowy fields. Thankfully, the snow was hard packed and I didn't sink down. And without coat or hat, I did not feel the cold at all. I made my way to a row of naked apple trees along a farm lane on the far side of the field. The next thing I knew is that I was standing in an intricate, breathtaking web of shadows beneath those trees, painted crisply and precisely on the pristine snow by brilliant moonlight falling through the denuded branches of the apple trees. Again, I was borne away, this time deep into the web in which I was standing, one with it. I cried from the beauty and magic of the experience, again cleansed and soothed. After a time, an unknown length of time, I made my way back to the house, still as warm as if I'd been wearing a parka. As I was recalling this experience, I was reminded of yet another occasion of which I've spoken previously, when I once again ran into nature's healing embrace during the extremely difficult time of my daughter's journey into mental illness and addiction. On that occasion, I was attempting to hold on to my sanity by getting away from my adult daughter who was experiencing psychosis. It can be very challenging to interact with a person in this state. Her communication was difficult to follow as she spoke very quickly, jumped from one topic to another, and forgot what she had been talking about. She tried desperately to get me to share her beliefs and trust her about things that she saw or perceived, which I could not. She made unrealistic demands of me, and I could not convince her of the impossibility of meeting her incessant requests. I fled down the road and into the trees, and, as I've previously shared, was once again strengthened and restored. And one other thing, before I turn to the two more recent experiences I mentioned at the opening of this episode. Considering the wording I've been using about being strengthened and restored, etc., by nature, I want to clarify a matter concerning humans' embrace of nature to be healed or nurtured. Nature actually does neither of those things, to put it bluntly. Nature neither likes nor dislikes its human aspect. Nature is neither malevolent nor benevolent towards us. I was reminded of this by a quote I saw on a plaque, I believe in the visitor center at Wrangell St. Elias National Park in Alaska. It said something to the effect that the wilderness is not hostile. It is only indifferent. And I would add, neither is it friendly. So the essence of your or my embrace with nature is whatever you or I make of it. The famous John Muir, naturalist, author, environmental philosopher, among other descriptors, famously said, "And into the forest I go to lose my mind and find my soul." It's not nature that effects those things, but rather the embracer of nature. Muir also said, "Climb the mountains and get their good tidings. Nature's peace will flow into you as sunshine flows into trees. The winds will blow their own freshness into you and the storms their energy, while cares will drop away from you like the leaves of autumn." Again, the flowing of peace or blowing of freshness into you, the energizing of you from storms, the dropping away of your cares, that's not nature gratuitously doing that for you. It's your openness and acceptance of you being an intrinsic, inextricable part of nature that enables you to experience nature as a healer and nurturer. With that clarification, on to Chapter 7, In Flow. This chapter consists of two previously written, subsequently amended blog posts. Here's my first story, which as a blog post I called Algonquin, A Happy Kind of Sadness. standing on the outfitter's dock and looking back across Ka'awaymog Lake and the autumn-colored hills beyond, I was overtaken by melancholy. Even though it had been an epic struggle against wind and white-capped waves to canoe across the endless lake to return to the starting point of our adventure, wet and chilled, I wanted to turn our canoe around and go right back into the Algonquin Park wilderness. I was surprised by the melancholy, but it was appropriate. I was feeling the happiness of being sad, as Victor Hugo defined the word. My 30-year-old son and I high-fived our accomplishment against the elements, and when he went into the outfitter's office to confirm the return of our rented canoe and gear, I felt tears threaten from a place deep inside. Happy, sad tears that I struggled to understand in the moment. Still, looking across the gray lake in my mind's eye, I could see the enchanted world that beckoned from the far side of the distant hills. Enchanted? So it was. But it wasn't the wilderness itself that made the experience magical. Although the natural elements within the boundaries of the world-renowned park have worked their magic on canoeists for hundreds of years, probably thousands of years, actually. For me, the enchantment was much more than that. Over 4 days and three nights, my son and I completed a canoe route across large and small lakes connected by portage trails. It seemed as if the tea-colored water through which we paddled, the low rounded mountains cloaked in evergreen, amber, gold, and red, and the sometimes gray, sometimes blue October sky belonged entirely to us. We saw no other humans for 3 days once past the first major portage. Perhaps no one would think the weather was magical, as we more often than not had our rain gear on while we paddled and portaged and wore several layers of clothing and toques as we slept. For the last two of our 4 days, the gusting winds were so strong that at times we had to summon all our energy just to keep our canoe in place on the angry open water as the bow of our little boat was lifted high by a frothy wave, dropped steeply into the succeeding trough, and then nosed sprayfully into the next wave. Testy as she may be, there was exhilaration and reward in our battle with Mother Nature. Within her spectrum of moods, we also experienced the tranquility of placid water under azure skies, at one point gliding silently in close proximity to a mama loon with her youngster at her side. That was magic. So was the mist-shrouded lake we awoke to on our first morning, a red rising sun in both sky and water the next dawn. So was the brilliant gold and white of sunlit birch protectively encircling our campsite as late afternoon edged towards evening. So was the eerie hoot and throaty growl of an unseen Canadian lynx in the dark. So was a ragged, shape-shifting sunset over wild, orange-stained waters. So was the black velvet night canopy strewn with brilliant diamonds. And so was the scent of autumn as our hiking boots crunched along portage trails quilted with discarded leaves of maple red, oak brown, and birch yellow. Magic. That was pure, natural, sensory magic. But as I said, it was more than that, a deeper magic. It was the deep sense of being an intrinsic, indistinguishable part of the present moment environment, falling with the gentle rain, flowing with the current, raging with the wind, silent in the silence. I was returned to the womb of nature, feeling her heartbeat, nourished by her richness. It was the deep erasure of the outside world of COVID-19, Trump, articles nagging to be written, grass to be cut, appointments to be kept. It was the deep primal call, the minimalism, essentialism, and simplicity of containing my shelter, my bed, my clothing, and my sustenance in two packs, one carried on my back and another strapped to my chest as we portaged, and leaving only the faintest of evidence to an experienced eye or nose of our passing as we traveled on. It was the deep comfort and fullness of being in the company of a loved one in the humanless wilderness, knowing he was asleep in his compact backpacker's tent on the opposite side of the fire pit from mine, breathing the same crisp, cleansing night air beneath the towering pines. This was the deepest, most special magic. What sleight of hand conjures up a mother's love that only increases with the passage of time, such that 30 years after we first came face to face in the delivery room, we were sitting side by side on a log cum bench with fire glow on our faces, feeling no compulsion to speak into the shared silence in the Algonquin backcountry. Sadness is always born out of a loss of some kind, and the melancholy I was experiencing standing on the outfitter's dock, looking back across Kawemog Lake to the hills beyond, was the happiness of being sad about the loss of that enchanted place. On the cusp of turning 65, would I ever be back again? When and how will I again experience such magic, achieve the precious state of being in flow, that immersion in the unmatchable feeling of energized focus? Did that being in flow explain why I felt no muscle aches in the following days, despite lugging 55 pounds of gear across numerous portages over 4 days, sleeping on a 1-inch thick air mattress for 3 nights, and leaning as forcibly as I could into my paddle to incessantly push against the wind and the waves for 4 hours on the last leg of our journey? It's certainly not attributable to me being anything more than a moderately fit senior. Was it a little bit of lingering magic? Was it testimony to the power of attitude over circumstance, mind over matter? Because I chose to love every moment of the adventure despite Mother Nature's moodiness, did my muscles and bones not find anything to complain about? I've done a number of such canoe trips and family camping vacations in my younger years, inevitably feeling the achy consequences of my physical exertions. I recall the joyful homeward bound anticipation of my soft bed and hot bubble bath and meals not cooked in a pot. But this time there was none of that. No creature comfort or convenience was so alluring as the call back across the lake into the solitude behind the autumnal hills, the call of the loon from deep within my soul. But I turned my back on it. I walked towards my car, towards my not-so-real life, feeling only the ache of happiness in my sadness. My next story begins 3 years later. This one is a blog post I called Takaka Falls, The Incalculable Cost of Comfort and Convenience. It quickly becomes almost a rant, you might say. Here in this story, beginning with a quote by Jennifer Skiff, "By immersing yourself in nature, you can experience a form of enlightenment. This is when the soul is free of fear and absorbs almost by osmosis the energy of life." End of quote. The Cree word takaka translates as magnificent in English. Magnificent is one word that describes my night sleeping near the base of the Takaka Falls in Yoho National Park, British Columbia. Others are restorative, immersive, elemental. My son and I drove up the mountain to reach the base of the falls as dusk was fading into night. We parked and hiked the 1.75 kilometers to the base of the falls. Having a height of 373 meters, they're the second tallest waterfall in Canada. We could hear the long tumble of water more than see it in the dark, but the nighttime experience with the Milky Way brilliant above the falls was special. On my autumn road trip through Alaska and the Canadian Rockies, sleeping near the falls wasn't my only numinous experience of feeling one with nature, of being in flow. Time and again, lying amongst the trees beneath a non-light-polluted, star-strewn sky, near fast-flowing or falling glacial meltwaters in a vast wilderness, I've been poignantly and viscerally reminded that I belong, that I'm an intrinsic part of a magnificent, much greater, all-encompassing creation. In stark contrast to this embracing immersion in nature, a few nights after Takaka Falls, due to extenuating circumstances, I found myself attempting to fall asleep in a king-sized, white-linened bed, much larger than my one-person camping tent, in a climate-controlled hotel room in the Canadian city of Edmonton, Alberta. With the curtains drawn to black out the urban night light and my eyes shut tight, I tried to recreate nature's darkness in the wilds. I tried to imagine the white noise of the air conditioner to be the soothing sound of water cascading down a mountainside. In my soft bed, surrounded by softer pillows, I tried to conjure the feeling of being grounded by the earth beneath my 1-inch-thick, 18-inch-wide sleeping mat. Breathing in the recycled hotel room air, I tried to recall my cleansing breaths of tree-freshened, crisp night air that drugged me into a deep sleep. Behind the double locked door, I yearned for the freedom of the wilderness. Surrounded by the creature comforts and conveniences of my hotel room, sleep eluded me. Instead of my mind contracting into slumber, it expanded into wakefulness. First, considering the hotel amenities, my bed that could theoretically sleep four, the large TV, the microwave, fridge and coffee maker, the climate controls, the jacuzzi tub, enough white bathroom towels to serve the four people who could theoretically fit in my bed, the complimentary breakfast served using disposable plates, cups and cutlery, the sanitizing of the linens and towels after my departure, the swimming pool and hot tub. Reeling over the cost of my hotel room, my mind could not find rest. But it wasn't the cost to my bank account that wreaked havoc with my peace of mind. It was the much larger cost. And further out, my restless mind expanded, considering the millions of similar hotel rooms around the world, catering to millions of travelers seeking comfort and convenience every night of every year. Travelers who have journeyed so, so far away from the natural world, alienated from the water, trees, and stars. It kept going, my mind, expanding even beyond the hotels into the houses of billions of humans across the globe, houses providing similar creature comfort amenities to a greater or lesser extent. And the cost of hotels? Never mind houses. As Statistic.com notes, in 2023, the hotel and resort industry market size worldwide reached $1.5 trillion. That's an industry useful cost that can be computed, but ultimately, it's not the most important or relevant cost, which is the incalculable cost of comfort and convenience to humanity. SustainableHospitalityAlliance.org is in an article called Only One Earth, What Can Hospitality Do to Protect It? Notes that individuals, all levels of government, businesses, and corporations need to be embedding environmental sustainability into decision-making and actions, and hospitality is no exception. I've extracted the following 4 points from the article. Number one, the hospitality industry contributes roughly 1% of global carbon emissions. It needs to reduce its emissions by 66% by 2030 and 90% by 2050 versus 2010 levels to ensure that the growth forecast for the industry does not lead to a corresponding increase in carbon emissions. The industry will need to go even further to help limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius and avoid the very worst impacts of climate change. Number two, single-use plastics make up roughly half of annual plastic production. Whilst the industry is taking action to eliminate single-use plastics from their operations, they remain prevalent in many hotels. It is estimated that by 2050, there will be more plastic in the ocean than fish. Number three, water is a fundamental resource in many hotel operations, such as heating and cooling, food and beverage, irrigation, spas and pools, and in guest rooms. In some locations, the average hotel guest uses 8 times more water than the local community members. And number four, nearly 1/3 of the world's species are currently threatened with extinction. This is a big problem for hospitality, which relies on the natural world to attract guests. The industry impacts biodiversity both directly, e.g. through land and resources use and pollution, and indirectly, e.g. through generating greenhouse gases and actions in the supply chain. Hotels or otherwise, our physical separation from nature is costly to our health. I think of it as separation anxiety. More correctly called nature deficit disorder, it pertains to the cost of human psychological and spiritual alienation from nature. Rampant addiction, anxiety, depression, and anger are increasingly interpreted as manifestations of our disconnect from the natural world. On a societal level, this separation is seen as a root cause of our extremely costly and deepening ecological crisis. Paraphrasing Ernst Schumacher, we humans do not experience ourselves as a part of nature, but as an outside force destined to dominate and conquer it, forgetting that if we win the battle, we'll find ourselves on the losing side. In my hotel room that night in Edmonton, my wide-awake mind troubled over humanity's destiny to dominate and conquer nature, and there I lay, feeling every bit on the losing side. Going back to Jennifer Skiff's quote that I opened this story with, I'm a loser because by not immersing myself in nature, I'm denying myself of experiencing a form of enlightenment. I'm a loser because I'm not feeling, freeing my soul of fear and not enabling it to absorb, almost by osmosis, the energy of life. My sharing this experience is not to disparage the hotel industry, which provides a crucial service to travelers disinclined or unable for a myriad of reasons to tent in the wilderness. It's a front desk wake-up call for awareness of the personal and environmental price we're paying for our very costly creature comforts and conveniences. I'm aware that we're at the end of our time today and invite you to tune in to the next episode of Better Me, Better World for talk about that steep personal price I paid for decidedly living out of flow for way too many years. I'll be back same time next week, same place here at CFRU 93.3 FM or CFRU.ca. The shows are recorded, so alternatively, have a listen when it works best for you. Until next time, be you. I'm Annie Gigg.